you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to be with you on this election day. It's California primary day and Super Tuesday across the country. And you're going to hear extensive coverage throughout the course of the day, not just from the polls in Southern California, but nationally on this Super Tuesday, with so many important issues and races being decided in a number of states. NPR's live coverage comes your way starting at 5 o'clock this afternoon and extends into the evening. At 7 o'clock, we will be joining forces with KQED, our fellow NPR station in San Francisco, for joint coverage. And then at 8 o'clock, I'll be joined by our civics and democracy correspondent, Frank Stoltz, and by our Orange County reporter, Jill Replogle. And right as the polls close at 8, the three of us will be taking to the air to bring you the very latest returns. We have a terrific team of experts to analyze those returns and where the races stand on this final day on election night. So please join us for our coverage. It all begins at 5 o'clock with a look at what's national with NPR, and I'll be joining you at 8 o'clock with our great LAist team in our studios throughout the course of the evening. Coming up a little bit later this hour, I want to hear from you what your experience of voting is like. I love to vote. I'm going to do it right after I leave today. Before I come back tonight for the evening coverage, I'm going to go to a local polling place not far from our studios and cast my ballot. I look forward to the preparation of it, even the ads. For me, the whole process is fun. It's interesting. Even with all the interviews that I conduct on the various topics, I still need more study in some cases to figure out how I want to vote. I want to hear from you later this hour what you like or don't like about the process of preparing for and casting your vote. That's in just a few minutes. But first, we begin with a controversy over whether a new law that goes into effect next month in California applies to Panera Bread fast casual franchises in California. That new law, starting April 1st, requires an additional higher minimum wage for fast food workers in the state than is the overall minimum wage. For fast food workers, it goes to $20 an hour. 16 is the regular minimum wage in the state. So $20 an hour is what's required to be paid as a minimum to fast food workers. But a report in Bloomberg that came out last week said that Panera Bread locations were exempt and not considered to be fast food for the purposes of this higher minimum wage. Since that report was published, a lot has happened. With us from Bloomberg News, reporter was part of the team that broke the story, Daniela Sertori Cortina. Thank you so much, Daniela, for joining us. Well, so much has come out of this since the original piece. The governor's office has denied that Panera has a carve-out. It says the $20 an hour would still apply to them. So what? Bring us up to date. What's the latest?
So, you know, as you know, the specificity of this carve-out, you know, has puzzled observers for months. And Governor Newsom was asked about the exemption during a September press conference, and he said it came about as part of the sausage making. As you mentioned, his office has since said that Panera may not be exempt. We did a follow-up story to our original story on March 1st, and we reported a statement from Newsom's office saying that until last week, the governor's staffers had understood that the bread exemption applied to Panera. And I quote here, they told us, because of your reporting, the lawyers have gone back and looked at the exemption and their analysis that Panera may not be exempt. So that's the latest.
Okay. And the reason that it might not be exempt is because the bread that's baked on location at Panera comes from dough that's pre-made and delivered to the location, as opposed to the dough actually created at the specific restaurant. Is that the rationale?
That is what the governor's office has told us. They did tell us as well that, you know, the governor's office is not the final word when it comes to implementing this legislation. The bill created a fast food council that, you know, may recommend changes. They also told us that the California Department of Industrial Relations, you know, they have enforcement authority over claims in individual cases. And they ultimately told us that the courts might actually have to make the final ruling on who qualifies or does not qualify.
Did they say what the justification was for excluding bakeries that do bake the bread on site and sell bread independently from sandwiches and the like?
What they have told us is that the exemption was about defining fast food from fast casual, and that they were trying to capture a definition of fast food restaurants that, you know, included establishments basically where workers had historically been underpaid. That is about the extent of what we have heard regarding the rationale for the exemption.
All right. And so you wrote in this piece last week that Panera Bread franchisee Greg Flynn, whose company owns a bunch of restaurants in different chains, not just Panera Bread locations, but his company has 24 Panera Bread locations in California, that he has been a longtime friend of the governor. They went to school together. He's contributed on multiple to multiple campaigns of the governor's. So in your story, you reported about this. So are there indications that Flynn had asked for special consideration and for Panera to be carved out of this? Is there any evidence that this was a sort of quid pro quo for donations?
So on March 1st, you know, our follow-up story, I know I keep bringing it up, but, you know, we quoted Flynn as saying that he did not ask for an exemption or special considerations. We initially reported that Flynn urged the governor's staff to reconsider whether fast casual chains such as Panera should be classified as fast food. In that story on March 1st that I keep referencing, we also reported that a statement from Flynn saying that he suggested excluding fast casual restaurants from the bill. And he also said that he met with Newsom's staff in a group meeting with other restaurants.
We're talking with Daniela Sirtori-Cortina, whose Bloomberg News reporter helped break this story last Friday in Bloomberg that got picked up. It's gotten a tremendous amount of attention in conservative media and is sometimes put in the same category as his move of eating at the French Laundry indoors during the time of COVID when California was putting requirements on people about not going gathering in places indoors. Also with us to talk about what's been dubbed Panera Gate is Jeannie Kwong, who's CalMatters California labor reporter. Jeannie, thank you for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's go back just to look a little bit at this $20 an hour fast food minimum wage. What was the reason behind this, as opposed to, you know, being fast casual or other restaurants? What was the reason for having a separate minimum wage for people that work in fast food as opposed to other entry-level positions?
Yeah, I mean, the fast food minimum wage was the culmination of a very long political effort by, you know, unions, by the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, and the Fight for 15 movement to raise working conditions standards in the fast food industry. So they started off a few years back with a bill before the state legislature to kind of enact this statewide, industry-wide standards board with worker representatives and company representatives to sort of, you know, it was sort of like an older model and a European model of setting workplace standards across the board, including wages, hours, safety conditions, that sort of thing, across the board, across an entire industry. And this was something that was that received a ton of industry pushback. This law passed in 2022, and that did include, as Danielle reported, that original law included that bakery carve-out already. It was signed by the governor in 2022. The industry, you know, all these big chains poured a ton of money to start gathering signatures, immediately put this to the ballot. So it was on the ballot for voters to decide whether or not to repeal it. It was going to be on this November's ballot. And then last year, the union and lawmakers then sort of responded by proposing additional regulations upon the fast food industry. And so that kind of touched off this back and forth and some deal making. And finally, last year, they came out with a deal and said, okay, the industry will back off and pull this measure off the ballot. They will agree to a $20 minimum wage for fast food workers. The new bill that was passed last year as part of the deal included defining fast food to chains with 60 or more locations nationwide. And they kind of pared back some of the powers of that standard setting council, although it does still exist and will be meeting soon this month. And yeah, so that's kind of how this all came about.
I guess I'm trying to understand. There's so many other types of jobs that are even more difficult and under worse working conditions and pay whatever the state minimum wage is, but they weren't considered in this. I'm trying to figure out what is it about fast food, or maybe it's just that they want to the unions want to unionize them, so it's a political play. But from a practical matter, I don't understand why fast food, as opposed to all these other industries, I mean, janitorial, the list is very long of low paying, even dangerous or inhospitable jobs, and the legislature didn't move to include them.
Yeah, I mean, I think you make a great point. But I think the reason that it always started out as being a bill that or a proposal that targeted this industry, and I think part of the reason is because that was, the SEIU's Fight for 15 movement just always chose that to begin with. Almost more than a decade ago, that was kind of the target, and I think that is a bit about politics. I mean, that is where they were able to organize workers to really rally behind this movement. And, I think they really pushed to make this industry front and center of their movement to raise the minimum wage for all workers. And so when it came to kind of forming, a more targeted effort, that's where they went.
We're talking with Jeannie Kwong, who's a Cal Matters reporter who covers California labor. We're talking about the reporting in Bloomberg last Friday that Panera Bread would not be subject to the $20 an hour minimum wage for fast food workers that goes into effect on April 1st of this year. The reason being that there's a carve out for bakeries in the legislation. The governor's office has responded that it doesn't appear to them that Panera Bread is exempted because the bread, though it's baked on premises, the dough is not made on the premises. It comes from a central distributed location and then is baked on site. So, but as we heard from Bloomberg reporter Daniela Sirtori Cortina, this may well have to be litigated and maybe years involved. So, Daniela, do we have a sense of what's going to happen on April 1st, whether Panera Bread and other, because there are other places like this. We have Corner Bakery and other chains like this that are sandwich and soup places. Do we know what happens to them April 1st? Daniela?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, now we can hear you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm here. I'm here. I'm here. Yeah, so far we have not reported any further comments from the companies. We have reached out to Panera and to Flynn just to get comment on this, and we haven't heard or reported anything else.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both so much for being with us and laying this out. So we'll see if this ends up in court and whether, in fact, Panera and other chains like it will be exempted from the $20 an hour fast food minimum wage, which goes into effect April 1st. Daniela Sirtori Cortina, part of the team that broke the story for Bloomberg News on last Friday, March the 1st. And my thanks to Cal Matters labor reporter Jeannie Kwong. It's Air Talk on LA's 89. 9.3. I want to hear from you. Please join us now because I want to start right off with calls when we come back from the break. What is it you particularly love or don't love about preparing for and voting on this California primary election day? I want to hear from you. I love the process of voting, but I know that's far from universal. And in fact, this is projected to be a low turnout election. I'd like to hear from you, your feelings about voting at 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722, or email your thoughts to atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Back with you in a minute.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. We're going to talk about voting on this election day. And I want to hear from you how you feel about the process. What is it that you like most? What is it you like the least about the process of voting? I'm also interested in hearing what you think about having such an extended pre-election period to cast your ballots. This, of course, is framed as giving people a much greater opportunity to be able to vote, and that early voting is helpful in building the percentage of people that participate in the process. I think you can also argue, though, that something is a bit lost in it because it doesn't concentrate sort of the excitement around the election. I do think it's taken some of the air out of the balloon, so to speak, by having a prolonged period of voting. And I do understand what those who like all the long early voting periods say about what it means for participation. I don't know what the effect is, though, when it comes to passion for an election and whether it has an effect. But I'd like to hear from you. How do you vote? What do you think is the best aspect of it? What is the worst? Do you like the fact that now it's been made more convenient to vote with all the drop-off locations, with all the vote centers in our local Southern California counties, and with an extended period to be able to cast your ballot? I always wait till the last minute anyway, because I don't know what's going to happen if a candidate's going to get sick. I don't know whether there's going to be an expose about one of the ballot measures that's published just days before election day itself. I want as much information as possible before I cast my ballot. So the early voting period for me is personally meaningless, but I know for some people they like it and find it convenient. I'd like to hear from you. We're at 866-893-5722. 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Now, back in 2022, Pew Research polled Americans about their feelings on voting. Around 7 in 10 U.S. adults say it's very important to vote in elections to be a good member of society. That's more Americans who say that about voting about any of the other activities the Pew Research included in their poll conducted in 2022. For example, by comparison, fewer than half of Americans say it's important. Now, remember, this is back when we're still dealing with COVID more in our faces, say it's more important than getting a COVID vaccine, or more important than making choices to help reduce the effects of global climate change, or to follow what's happening in politics in their own country. So we see that for the overwhelming majority of Americans, more than two-thirds say that to be a good member of society, it is absolutely critical to vote. So I'd like to hear from you how you feel about voting, especially in this time, this election, where it appears comparatively few members of the public will take part. 866 893-5722, 866-893-5722. Dave in West Hollywood says, this is the first voting cycle that I'm not excited about voting. It's an apathy that hit me this year. I'm an older voter. This is the first time that I felt this way. Well, Dave, you are not alone. I mean, looking at the projected turnout, and what the registrars in Southern California have seen. And you know, part of it, I think, is that in most parts of California, it is a one-party state. And so you are, if you're a registered Democrat, you're deciding between Democrats in the primary period. And they're probably going to be pretty closely aligned in the majority of policies. You're looking for some of the differences, say, in the U.S. Senate race, if you're a Democrat, and you're trying to decide between three primary Democratic candidates that are running, and you're looking for what are arguably nuances in many of those perspectives, or how they as people affect you. People, you know, don't just vote based on policies, and rightly so. Policy is only a part of it. The person who you want to represent you, who you want to look at as a leader, that I argue is important too. And so you're looking for those stylistic or personal differences that are important to you in a candidate. But in what is largely a one-party state, when it comes to statewide offices, that, you know, takes probably some of the pleasure out of it, because you're not getting, you know, sweeping differences in perspectives in front of you. Reed in Sherman Oaks, good to have you with us. So, Reed, how do you feel about voting these days?
Hey, Larry. I have, like you, I've always appreciated getting all the information before I vote, and so I've always voted at the last minute as well. But something that's kept me from voting in the past, and that very well may keep me from voting today, is that my job doesn't offer paid time to vote. And I think that if voting day was a national holiday, that early voting wouldn't be necessary, because everyone could just use the time they're given paid to vote.
Yeah. So you couldn't vote when they open at 7 in the morning, or vote just before 8 when they close? Your day is longer than the open and the close window?
Yeah, I've been working as a first responder, so there's not always times when I can.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you're at the mercy of obviously what's happening at any given time. Well, there of course also is vote by mail, which has always existed. So, given your job, you know, you could have just asked to be what they used to call permanent absentee, and then just do a mail-in ballot every year. But that's not as exciting, is it, as going to the polling place?
No, definitely not. I didn't know that was an option as well.
Yeah, you can do that. Absolutely. Of course, now everybody gets mailed a ballot. But, you know, back a few years ago, you could just tell your county registrar, put me down as permanent absentee. And then they would just every election send you the ballot to fill out, and you send it back with your vote. Reed, thank you so much. 866-893-5722. Omri in Beverly Hills says, I prefer in-person same-day voting over vote by mail. I think voting by mail encourages uninformed voters to vote. Omri, thank you so much. 866-893-5722. Matt in Sherman Oaks says, I disagree with you, Larry. I think there are two parts of the Democratic Party, the DSA, which is the Democratic Socialist wing, and then the middle-of-the-road Democrats. I think a lot of the middle-of-the-road Dems are the ones who are going to be voting today. That's Matt in Sherman Oaks. Matt, you're absolutely right. And I don't mean to say all Democrats are the same, but it's certainly not the range of political perspectives that you get where there's active two parties, where the spread is going to be much greater on a variety, particularly of social issues. 866-893-5722. Let's talk with Sky in Tustin. Sky, how do you feel about the process of voting? What do you like? And if there's something you don't, what's that?
Hi, Larry. Good morning. I'm 32 years old, and for me, voting is just as special and important as it was when I was 18 years old. When it comes to the primaries and the presidential election, especially between my group of friends, what I found is that everybody has an opinion on left, right, red, blue, everybody has an opinion on Trump or Biden, but when it comes to local elections, things that really influence us, I can tell you not one of my friends knows anything about the ballot, who's running for state or local elections. And for me, everyone has an opinion about the big elections. But when it comes closer to home, nobody, at least in my age group, really knows what's going on. And it's like, if you're going to go ahead and vote for presidential, go the extra mile, do your research, and really find out what's happening locally that affects our schools, our parks, et cetera.
Sky, so beautifully said, and you're absolutely right. It's those local issues and local candidates that actually have a much bigger effect on your life because they're closer to home. The other thing is that your vote carries much more weight in local elections. We've had, in recent years, a number of races that have been decided by just a tiny number of votes. So your vote is particularly important. And I would add on top of that, when you've got an election like this, which appears that it's going to be a fairly low participation election, your vote is even more powerful. With fewer people voting, your vote actually carries more clout. So, you know, if anything, I would argue, make sure you vote in what are called low turnout elections. That's where you really have the clout you don't necessarily have when it's a very high turnout election. Sky, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And I think you're absolutely right, Sky, that of the general public, people just don't pay as much attention to the local issues. Now, that's not true of Air Talk listeners. We talk about this stuff all the time. It's our bread and butter. You're clearly into that because you're listening. But I think Sky's absolutely right. When you're talking about the general voting population, the local stuff often just falls by the wayside. John in West Los Angeles, so good to have you with us. What are your thoughts about voting and the way we do it now?
I have two points. That mail-in voting turned it from being something we're excited about. It's voting day. Get out and vote. Take some time off of work. Get to the polls and turned it into voting week. You know, turn in your ballot. And then the counting of voting mail-in ballots delays the result. So it's no longer we sit in front of the TV watching the news or listening to NPR. What are the results? What are the results? We all know it's going to take days for the real results to come across.
Yeah, I think it's made the process more boring. I have to agree with you, John. But I'm sure the registrars would say, well, we'll take higher participation over boring, that's the greatest value. Voting is so important, and getting the highest degree of participation is of such value that, yeah, this, by stretching it out, takes a bit of the anticipation and sense of event out of it, but there's a greater good. What do you say to that, John, to that argument?
I say that stretching it out doesn't actually, in the long run, doesn't actually increase participation. It might increase ballot harvesting, which I think is a bad thing. I think what we really want is personal engagement. And mail-in balloting just doesn't have that same personal engagement as walking to the poll, greeting the poll sitters, who are really the poll helpers, who I really like to greet, and participating in the whole thing. I think we've really sacrificed something by going to mail-in.
John, I really appreciate your call. 866-893-5722. We also have some email input. Nancy in Garvanza in Highland Park emailed, seems like the low turnout, high apathy nature of this election makes it even more important than usual that we do vote. Maybe it's my suspicious nature, but I think a tiny turnout leaves an open field for all kinds of unpleasant possibilities. And P.S., I submitted my ballot last week, and I've received confirmation that it's been received and counted. Nancy, I really like that. I love when I get that text message that says my ballot has been received and that it's been counted. I like being able to track it like that, which is a really nice thing that LA County does, and presumably other counties do that as well. And Nancy, I would certainly underscore what you said. You know, if you're debating, oh, should I take part? This is projected to be low turnout. If there's any election you want to vote in, it is this one. So I would never tell people to vote. We don't advocate here. That's not my job. Tell people what to do. I would just say, in terms of if you're inclined to vote, your vote does carry more weight in a low turnout election. Linda and Toluca Lake emailed, I was one of the first cohort of 18-year-olds to vote in 1972, and I haven't missed an election since. Linda, that's wonderful. I'm with you. I haven't missed an election since I was eligible to vote. I love to vote. I look forward to voting. It is just a tremendous opportunity, and there's no way to take it for granted. Lupe in Hastings Ranch, Pasadena says, every time you're debating about voting or not, think about all of our soldiers. It's a privilege to vote, young or old, no excuse. That's Lupe in Hastings Ranch, East Pasadena. 866-893-5722. Let's talk next with Ben in Venice. Ben, thank you for joining us. What is it you particularly like about this election season?
Oh, yeah, Larry, thanks for having me. You hit the nail on the head there. I love voting, and I totally agree with you, but these ads, they're so cringe. They're so fun to watch. They're just over the top. And so I watch the news every night at 11, and almost every ad recently has been a political ad. And, I love them. They're great.
Yeah, I love them, too. Of course, the greatest of all time may be the Demon Sheep ad that was run years ago. You can find that on YouTube. Speaking of cringy and weird, Ben, thank you so much. 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Julia in South Pasadena, so good to have you with us. What do you particularly appreciate about the way we do elections now?
Well, basically, I feel that it gives you time to look at things, to research things, to discuss it. I have no problem with mail-in ballot. You know, it gives you that time. And I hand-delivered mine over at the South Pasadena Public Library, and I asked questions there, and they said I could have a new ballot if I wanted. So I don't feel that it's an either-or situation. I think it's really important to vote. And if you want that voting experience, then just walk in there with your ballot, deliver it, or get a new ballot and vote.
Yeah, I would argue it's not the same experience to do that now, but I hear what you're saying. It doesn't have the same sort of excitement as it did on election day when you see your neighbors and everybody in line to vote. I don't think it's the same level of excitement, but I hear what you say about, you know, and you're not going to have the lines if you vote earlier. It does make for a very quiet and peaceful experience to be able to go vote. And I certainly take the efficiency of it that you say. But again, we've always had the ability to vote by mail. That's not new. What's new is that everybody is now sent a ballot. And so that it makes it more efficient for people who want to vote. That way they don't have to make a request to get a mail-in ballot. The onus is not on them to do it because everybody gets it. Julia, thank you so much. Let's talk with Jim in Huntington Beach. Jim, share with us your thoughts around voting this time.
Yeah, I never miss an opportunity to vote, and I really struggle to understand the apathy, you know, because elections absolutely make a difference. My struggle with it is in the voting for things like judges, and, you know, assembly people and offices where we don't know anything about the people. And we're asked to vote on these different people who eventually, as they rise in their political careers, they might actually be more prominent and be running for a higher office. But
yeah,
we don't know anything about them.
Jim, it's an excellent point. On the judges, I would point you, as well as for a wide range of other aides to help you with your voting process, to go to las.com/vote. We have their details on the judges, their backgrounds, information about the LA County judges that are there. You're in Orange County, and so I know you don't have, we don't have the judges for Orange County this time around. Hopefully we will in the future. And I don't know if the Register has recommendations and if they explain their reasoning, because you wouldn't necessarily just follow what a newspaper says, but it's helpful if you know what their rationale is is, what filters that they used for coming to their endorsement decisions. And on the state legislative races, you're absolutely right. You get these lists of endorsements or what their associations have been, but because there are so many districts in this media market, it's very difficult to determine a lot about their background. Jim, thank you so much. Jean in Irvine says, this election, I took more time to study everything. This is the first time I've really dug into the issues and candidates. I listened to Larry's interviews, found them very helpful. I'm proud of myself. Jean, thank you so much. And you should be. It's a great feeling of satisfaction. I feel that too. When I've really thoroughly prepared, it's very fulfilling to feel like you're an informed voter. Kimberly in Silver Lake said, I used to love voting, but now I'm just anxiety-ridden because I feel like so much is on the line. I feel like the future of democracy and the planet is on the line. Kimberly, I think many voters feel as you do. The advantage, of course, to voting is it gives you something to do about it. You're not just passively there, seeing things unfold in front of you, but you're an active participant involved in the process. Thank you all. So many comments. I don't have time to read them all, but I appreciate it. Oh, and we do have the Orange County judges. My apologies. We do have the Orange County judges on the voter game plan. We have also other Orange County races that are laid out there. Jill Replogle, who will be joining me tonight at 8 o'clock for our local election coverage. We'll be talking about all those Orange County races, and I didn't realize Jill had gone through and put together the Orange County judges. My bad. It's there for you, Jim. So look that up at LAist.com/vote. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. We'll be back in 90 seconds.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
UCLA's got the ball. 3-2-1. The shot from outside, no good. There's the horn. The game is over, and UCLA, the NCAA champions for 1967, a team that went through 30 games without a loss and defeated Dayton here in the finals tonight, 79-64. So UCLA, the team they said would win, it did, and form certainly held up as the UCLans were master of the situation in both games once they arrived here in Louisville. In fact, they were the master all season long with that perfect now 30 wins without a loss record.
That was the year that then Lou Alcindor, now Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, was a sophomore with the UCLA Bruins. That 1967 title was Coach John Wooden's third, his first following an undefeated season. Kareem posted a double-double in the game, 20 points, 18 rebounds. A longtime Kentucky Wildcats play-by-play man, Kay Wood Ledford, on the call there. This part of an incredible run of titles for UCLA with an array of talent that would go on to star in the NBA, as well as be civic leaders in the community after their playing days. But as UCLA was such a well-oiled machine on the basketball court for a decade plus, there were a lot of bumps along the way, and they're detailed in a new book by Scott Howard Cooper, longtime sports writer, including for the LA Times. His book is Kingdom on Fire, Kareem, Wood, Walton, and the Turbulent Days of the UCLA Basketball Dynasty. Scott, so good to have you with us today on Air Talk.
Good morning. It's great to be with you.
So let's first describe the cast a bit. We have, of course, the mild-mannered John Wooden, a man from the Midwest, known for his deep religious faith and for being super detailed about how his players should take off and put on their socks and prepare for practice even before they hit the court. He's of an extreme personality, fair to say, but he has these two giants in Kareem and in Walton, who are his dominant players with two different generations of Bruin teams. What were their personalities like?
They were similar in that they were introverted, They were very focused on their studies. They cared about the education. That's one of the reasons they came to UCLA. They were team first players, unselfish to a fault. And that's what made the whole thing work, because if Lou Alcindor, as he was, of course, before Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, if he would have come from New York, and when Bill Walton came from San Diego, if either one of them would have had that different personality of where's my shots and I demand the spotlight and I'm the superstar, seven in a row never would have happened. 10 and 12, 10 championships in 12 years never would have happened. But their personalities were all about spread the joy, keep the ball moving. Let's just play fun and win games. And I don't care if my name doesn't appear in the paper at all.
An 88-game winning streak there, along with all the titles that you mentioned between 1965 and 75. It's an incredible run. This also a period of intense civil rights and anti-war activism in America. Then Lou Alcindor arrives from New York City, as you said. His father, a very politically active person, he grows up immersed in the after effects of the Harlem Renaissance, of a New York City, a very vibrant place for a young African-American man. And he comes with a political consciousness to UCLA, but also great respect for John Wooden. Was there friction between the two men politically?
Not so much politically as much as socially. And friction is probably the best way to describe it, because it never was, there never was a time where they didn't get along. There were times where they disagreed. And that's the same thing that can be said for Bill Walton, that there was a fair amount of eye rolling and some friction, but it never got to a point where it was a problem. There always was a respect from Lou Alcindor to John Wooden, and the same was returned. I think that there were moments that they were on opposite sides. One of the things that I detail in the book was that John Wooden thought it was an honor to serve in the military. He did so himself. He was in the Navy. And Lou Alcindor, of course, was never going to have to go into the military when you're 7'1". That was a non-issue. But Lou was a very vocal supporter of Muhammad Ali at the time that Ali was refusing to enter the draft. And that was a source of tension between the two. And so there were a few moments like that. But because they were both intelligent and reasonable, even Lou Alcindor as a freshman or a sophomore was very mature. And that helped them get through the tough times.
We're talking with sports writer Scott Howard Cooper. His new book, Kingdom on Fire, Kareem, Wooden, Walton, and the Turbulent Days of the UCLA Basketball Dynasty. I remember as a kid listening to the radio and a newscast which said that Bill Walton, the UCLA center, was arrested at a demonstration on the UCLA campus. I believe it shut down an intersection nearby or something like that. And my first thought as a kid was, what is John Wooden going to think about, you know, about this? And how did Wooden take to Walton's anti-war activism?
He had no problem with the activism in terms of Bill having an opinion and doing things that were within a person's rights. Marching, protesting, speaking out, that's all fine. John Wooden did not expect everybody to share his opinion, but when it got into breaking the law, that's where they had a problem. And I think that John Wooden was very frustrated, even angered by what happened, not because Bill was taking a stand that was the opposite of his, but because Bill got arrested. And also he understood how that would reflect on how he, John Wooden, would understand how that reflected on his basketball program. That was one of their bad moments. In conversation with Bill, he told me that's one time that coach was really angry at him, that they had disagreed on many occasions, but that was real anger and real frustration. And one of the interesting sidelights that I talk about in the book, John Wooden's son Jim was a Marine who served overseas for many years, and by that time was back in the U.S. and going to all the UCLA games. The whole Wooden family went, and he wanted to punch. He thought about punching out Phil Walton. He was really frustrated by that, and he and Bill ended up becoming friends. And again, the same thing as with his dad, Jim Wooden did not have a problem with protesting the war. It was just it got into things like destruction of property on campus and different things like that. And so it was emotional for both sides, not just pro-war and anti-war, but the Wooden side and the Walton side.
How does Bill Walton look back on that now? I mean, he's such a gregarious person. I mean, to the point where his broadcasts that he does today are just series of anecdotes, irrelevant often of what's happening on the court. But how does he look back on that now? And is he proud that he protested in that way? Does he have any regrets? How does he see it?
His regrets are the way he carried himself in a lot of ways. You're so right to bring up the Bill Walton that everybody knows now, and you can't get him to shut up, and he goes on these long tangents. And believe me, as someone who's known Bill for many years, I know that that's not just what he does on TV. That's just who he is. That's just his enthusiasm for life that's coming through. But at the time, he was very difficult to be around. His teammates liked him. But he was very shy. He had a horrible speech impediment for much of his life, certainly in his early years. And he did not want to interact with people because of that. And it between that and hating the attention, and obviously he got a great deal of attention, he just did not want to interact with people. He was a great communicator on the court, which, as any basketball fan knows, is a big help when you're the last line of the defense, you're calling out instructions to your teammates. He was great at that, but stop him on campus or want to do an interview with him in the media or something like that, and you got an entirely different Bill Walton. Mm. And he looks back on it with regret. He told me, frankly, boy, I was terrible at times. I really feel bad about the way I acted. And that's one of the things that makes 2024 Bill Walton so wonderful, is that he's introspective in that way. And he's able to look back and say, boy, I was just too immature. I did not handle the situations well.
We're talking with Scott Howard Cooper, author of Kingdom on Fire, Kareem, Wooden, Walton, and the Turbulent Days of the UCLA Basketball Dynasty. An excerpt of your book was recently published in the Los Angeles Times, and I loved it because it brought Jerry West into this triangle and makes it a square. And I love detailing the back room of the diner in Westwood, where Jerry West, then a player for the Lakers, of course, from rural West Virginia, and a guy with you know, a lot of anxiety and stress on him, would sit back there, and John Wooden would be back there, and Walton would join. And I'm just thinking, all these characters, these larger than life figures, if only you could have added Chick Hearn to that back room and brought yet another larger than life figure. I mean, what is it that in this period of time we had so many characters, so many just one-of-a-kind personalities in one place?
That's one of the things that really drew me to the book, and I'm so glad that the LA Times chose to highlight that portion, because that was one of the things I feel like really brought the story to life. It was such an LA portion to run, and that was terrific. But that's one of the things that really drew me to the project was, oh my gosh, you got Jerry West in it. Dick Vermeil suddenly shows up. Gary Beebe and the Heisman Trophy winner. We talk about Muhammad Ali and Jim Brown and Bill Russell and Neil Young. There's a portion in there about music in the Hollywood Hills and the growth of the LA music scene. There are all these moments where I would kind of write a portion and stop and think, I can't believe we just talked about Neil Young or something like that. It was an amazing time, and so much of it came together, and we haven't even touched on John Wooden and his connection to the White House, and Lou Alcindor and his connection, I just referenced it, to Muhammad Ali and things like that, that UCLA was not just in those times. UCLA was part of those times, and that was the whole purpose of the book, was not just to say they won a lot of games,
yeah,
but to set it against that backdrop of what was going on all around them.
And I as a fan of the team growing up during this period, and I'm young, but I had a sense of that. You know, you really fill in the gap. You detail in what ways this team was such a part of the zeitgeist and influential culturally. I felt that as a kid in the city, but you really lay out what the reasons for that feeling were. It's a terrific book and just absolutely fascinating for fans of this historic dynastic era of UCLA basketball and of Los Angeles culture of that era from the mid-60s to the mid-70s. I just highly recommend Scott's book, Kingdom on Fire, Kareem Wooden Walton and the Turbulent Days of the UCLA Basketball Dynasty, an extraordinary look at some extraordinary personalities in our city at that time. Scott, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you for a great conversation.
Appreciate it. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle, just reminding you that our continuous election coverage on this California primary day and Super Tuesday nationally begins at 5 o'clock with NPR live coverage coast to coast. At 7 o'clock, we join with KQED San Francisco, NPR member station, for statewide coverage, and then I'll be with you at 8 o'clock until late into the night with local returns.
274 newly built units have sat empty for more than 60 days.
I'm Nick Gerda. In my news stories on homelessness, I follow the money, hold officials accountable, and tell you which policies are working, which are not, and how that affects people here in Southern California. I'm proud my reporting for LAist helped fast-track VA housing for veterans in West LA and force an accounting of millions of taxpayer dollars in Orange County.
LAist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your day's going well on this California primary day. Polls close at 8 o'clock. Just a reminder, you need to get your ballot in by that time, and it's got to be postmarked if you're using the U.S. Postal Service. It's got to be postmarked by 8 o'clock tonight for it to count. It will be counted if it is postmarked within that time frame, but just need to make sure that you get that so that your ballot is counted. So good to have you with us today. LA Mayor Karen Bass coming up just a little bit later on this election day. It'll be good to talk with her about a number of important issues. And we begin with the future of Hollywood Burbank Airport, which is controlled by a three-city commission. Burbank, Glendale, and Pasadena's Airport Authority is the operator of Hollywood Burbank. And they announced groundbreaking of a more than $1 billion budgeted new terminal for the airport. It'll be constructed north of the current terminal at the intersection of Winona and Hollywood Way. Thornton and Hollywood Way is where the current historic terminal has been. So I know people are interested in finding out what all the new amenities, the architecture, all the advantages of the new facility. But of course, there are concerns about whether the character of the old Hollywood Burbank, the quaint facility that I just dropped my son off at Sunday night and appreciated how easily one can get in and out of it, whether that might be lost in this major renovation of Hollywood Burbank. Joining us to talk about that is Frank Miller, Executive Director of the Burbank Glendale Pasadena Airport Authority, which operates Hollywood Burbank. Frank, thank you for being with us.
Well, good morning, and thank you for the invitation.
It's a very attractive-looking new terminal with almost kind of mid-century elements, mid-20th century elements to it, with a sweeping elevated roof line. Share with us how the design was chosen.
Well, the first thing that we wanted the architect to do was to come up with three concepts that we would use as we proceed with the planning and design of the terminal. The image that you were just talking about is called the Icon, and it was selected by the authority as the image of the new terminal following an effort and an outreach effort in Burbank, Glendale, and Pasadena for people to view the three concepts and to tell us which ones they liked. And overwhelmingly, they chose the Icon. And so that is to kind of give a sense of Burbank mid-century, as you had mentioned, with a sweeping canopy going from the garage towards the terminal building, reminiscent somewhat of the media influence and soundstage. So it's trying to capture some of the essence of Burbank as we build this new facility.
Yeah, I like it. I think it's a very attractive design. So is the building going to be essentially along Hollywood Way, or how is it going to be laid out at that intersection of Winona and Hollywood Way?
The Winona will now be the access going up to the terminal building. It'll be on the other side of the development that you see from Hollywood Way. And that's all part of the project. Is that as we build the terminal building, of course, we'll now be constructing an access road that will move up towards the terminal building and loop around and then return on Winona back to Hollywood Way.
So you'll be driving in west on Winona and then you'll loop north to go along the front of the terminal?
Correct.
Okay. And how many gates will it have versus what you've got currently?
Well, it's always been called the replacement passenger terminal building. And the main reason for that, of course, is that we are not adding any new gates. We will continue to operate with 14 gates. But with the design that we will have and the location of the new terminal, we'll be a lot more efficient in how we can process passengers through the airport. And by doing that, to also make it more efficient for the aircraft and provide the convenience of some growth here at the airport once the passenger terminal is in full operation.
How much bigger is the footprint with the same number of gates?
We're going from about 250,000 plus or minus to a 355,000 square foot terminal building.
Okay, so there'll be a lot more spacious, which will be nice because the concourse currently is, of course, gets heavily crowded when you've got multiple flights arriving at the same time during peak, Friday night, Sunday evening periods at the airport. And it looks like the ceilings are going to be significantly taller as well.
They will be. We will have a more expansive feel for the passengers as they come through the terminal building. As you pointed out, it's very closed in currently in the concourses. So we want to vastly improve that experience of more area as they move through the gates. And we will also be expanding the security checkpoints. So it will really provide an advanced customer experience.
All right. We're talking with the executive director of the Burbank Glendale Pasadena Airport Authority, which operates Hollywood Burbank Airport, Frank Miller, with us to talk about it. So what's the timeline for the terminal to open?
Well, on the 15th of this month, we will receive the 60% design from the architects and the contractor. We will be reviewing those. We will most likely be in the bond market in early May. And then as we move forward into the third and fourth quarter, we'll start to see a lot more activity going on. We have some early work that's being done today. But that's the grading and things that are necessary for us to move forward. Once we start the project, we anticipate that in the fourth quarter of 2026, we will be opening the new passenger terminal building.
I was talking with some friends about Hollywood Burbank Airport, and they're saying, how drab it is if your flight gets delayed and, not the most fun place to sit and wait for your flight. But I reminded them when that airport opened, you didn't have the kind of flight delays that you have now. It just was not as busy and you weren't sitting in that airport. When it opened, you could decide you wanted to have dinner in San Francisco. You could drive to the airport, buy a ticket for a flight that was scheduled to leave within the hour, just get on the plane without any security, take off. You could be in San Francisco within 2 hours from the decision that you wanted to go there to have dinner that night. It's such a totally different way that we fly now than when that airport opened. And that's hard for us to consider how different it was.
It was very different. When we talk about this terminal, it was opened in 1930. So it is incredible that this building continues to provide the service and the convenience to the traveling public. But as we go into the new terminal building, one of the things that we're very cognizant of is the concessions. You know, what type of food and beverage, what type of retail, where do those go? How does that affect the flow of the passengers? So that's all part of the discussion that we're having. And as far as the convenience, one of the things that we heard loud and clear during the charrette meetings that we had, people like walking out to the airplanes. They like boarding from the front and the back on Southwest, as an example. That's going to remain.
That's great news.
Yes, we are not putting in what we call a loading bridge. It's a single floor portion of the terminal building. So they'll walk out as they do today to board the aircraft. So we just want to assure everybody that as we build this new terminal, we don't want to forsake the convenience that everyone is used to having here in Burbank. We want to continue to provide and be the most convenient airport in the LA area.
I'm so surprised to hear this, Frank, because I had assumed for safety and other reasons that the rear exit and entrance to the plane was not going to be available anymore, particularly since, you know, the rear staircase, it's not accessible for people with disabilities. But that's terrific that it's still going to be available, because you can board into planes so much faster.
That's the beauty of that, especially for Southwest and Alaska Airlines, that, you know, they fly in with the 737s and they'll both use that boarding method. And it really does facilitate and it makes the turn, as we call it, of those aircraft a lot shorter. And even with this continuing this approach, with the new terminal building, the building and the actual parked aircraft will be farther away from the runways than they are today. So it works well for us. We're having meeting with accessibility agencies in Burbank, Glendale, Pasadena. We want to look at what accessible issues are for people that are in wheelchairs or if they're blind, if they're deaf. We want to consider all of that as we continue to design the building.
William in Pasadena asks, who's footing the bill? What's the return on investment? Why do this? The airport works now.
Well, the airport, the terminal building, doesn't meet the FAA criteria for distance from the center line of a runway. The building opening in 1930, the seismic capability of the terminal clearly isn't what anyone would want. So there are reasons that we really have to build this new terminal. As far as the cost of it, the entire project, and not just the terminal, but the road systems, the infrastructure that we have to put in place, the new garage, it's about a $1.2 billion project. The way we are financing this is using a lot of FAA federal dollars to support this project. At the end of the day, though, as I mentioned earlier, we will be going into the bond market. We will be issuing bonds. They're called a general airport revenue bond. And the airlines that operate out of this airport, once we've applied all the additional ancillary revenue that we get here at the airport from land leases, from concessions in the terminal building, from our parking fees, the airlines, under the agreement that we have with them, will be paying the remaining amount through their rates and charges. So the airport is totally self-sufficient. There will be no money coming from any of the three cities that make up the authority. So it's a very good model. The airlines are very supportive of this project, even though they know their costs to operate here will increase. But they also recognize the advantages of having a new terminal and being a lot more efficient.
We're talking with Frank Miller, the executive director of the Burbank Glendale Pasadena Airport Authority, which owns and operates Hollywood Burbank Airport. It's getting a $1.2 billion makeover with a brand new terminal, same number of gates, though. If you have questions for Frank Miller, we're at 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. 5722. You can also email your input to atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Lance in Pasadena says, if it ain't broke, 866-893-5722. I also wonder about the electrical, though, Frank. I've been in Hollywood Burbank Airport, I think, twice in the past 2 years when the power went out. I don't know if you've got an overstressed electrical system there or whether that's a City of Burbank thing, but I assume this will be a significant electrical upgrade in the new digs.
It will, and we are having a lot of very positive conversations with the City of Burbank and the power company about how we will be providing power to this facility, the increased load, obviously, that will occur with the new building. And we also talk about the need for some redundancy and the ability to have some additional power sources if there is a power outage from the main substation that would power the airport.
All right. And I wanted to ask you about waiting areas as well, because it isn't the most comfortable airport to wait at. Everybody hopes their flight isn't delayed so they won't have to sit in the chairs there. And often there aren't enough chairs at a given gate. So will there be better ergonomically designed chairs in the waiting areas and more spacious waiting areas at each gate?
The waiting areas will be larger and as part of the overall layout of the terminal building. And we are having meetings, and we are discussing the type of seating that we will have. Obviously, we want it to be as comfortable as possible. And all of that is part of what we're doing.
Fred in San Marino asks, will there be space for lounges in the new terminal?
Unfortunately, with 355,000 square feet, there really isn't an opportunity for a separate or a private lounge.
All right. Heidi in Studio City, can you comment on the impact flights have had on areas like Studio City and Encino? We have over 300 flights a day now, and we've registered many complaints to the airport. That's Heidi in Studio City. Frank?
Well, we have had some complaints about the noise. As we've said, we're not adding any additional gates. We're staying at 14. Obviously, there's the opportunity for additional flights coming in, or the airlines can be what we call upgrading their aircraft and bringing in airplanes that would have more seating than what we have today. We understand that there is a concern about that, but what we look at is that the way that the airport will operate will continue as it is today. We're not doing anything to lengthen a runway. We're not adding any additional runway. So our project right now is strictly about providing a better experience at the airport for the people who are flying out.
Now, I assume at this point you haven't put out RFPs for different restaurants and travel shops and things like that. But what do you anticipate the airport authority will be looking for with those amenities in the new terminal?
Well, we will be putting out the RFPs or bids here very shortly for the concessions for food and beverage and retail. What we like to do is, and the way the industry typically does it is we will put out the information and provide potential bidders information about the new terminal, about the amount of space that we feel will be available for them. And then we go through a process where the proponents then come back to us and they provide us with their thoughts of what types of actual concession activities will go in any one location. That will be a part of the selection process, and we'll be looking at how the offerings that are being proposed fit in with what we think is something that Burbank would want, and if there's any type of local businesses that would be a part of that bid. Those are the types of things that we would take a look at.
Cindy and Reseda emailed to ask, will the baggage carousel still be outside? My bags have gotten soaked.
baggage belts will now be inside, and we appreciate all the patience that people have had, because while it is a pleasant experience here and there's a lot of history here, there are things like having exterior baggage belts that really aren't what we want to see for the new terminal building.
Yeah, it's not going to guarantee bags stay dry, though. I mean, because there is the transfer from the jet to the terminal building. And, you know, even if you're at LAX, you can get wet bags back just because in the transfer process, they got wet before they got into the building. So that's still a risk, even with an indoor carousel.
That's correct, yes.
Frank, thank you so much for talking with us about what's anticipated here with Hollywood Burbank Airport's new terminal to come in future years. Thank you so much for sharing the details with us.
Thank you for having me. And if I could just say very quickly, if people go online to Elevate Burr, they'll be able to get some more information about the project.
Sounds great. Thank you. That's Frank Miller, Executive Director of the Burbank Glendale Pasadena Airport Authority, which owns and operates Hollywood Burbank Airport. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, we'll be talking with LA Mayor Karen Bass. So much to talk with her about. A reminder, our live election coverage starts with NPR at 5 o'clock this afternoon. And you're still going to have Nick Roman with you throughout the afternoon drive time. Nick will be there along with all your favorite NPR analysts. And then at 7 o'clock, it's a joint statewide broadcast with KQED San Francisco, and our Austin Cross will be part of that broadcast between 7 and 8. And then at 8 o'clock, it's Frank Stoltz, our civics and democracy correspondent, Jill Replogle, who covers Orange County, and me. We'll be bringing you the latest returns and an array of analysts from 8 o'clock until late into the night. So it's complete election coverage with LAist 89.3 and NPR starting at 5 today. We'll be right back with Mayor Bass in just a minute.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of the How to LA podcast. How about we go to the movies? Join us for a 10-part series, Revival House, and discover the magic of LA's indie theaters. Who knows? You might meet someone.
I know it sounds antithetical because you're just sitting passively, but in fact, you're connecting with everyone else around you.
Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios, wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Air Talk on this California primary day and Super Tuesday across the country. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. And we're joined by Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass. Happy Election Day, Mayor Bass. Think she's there. Mayor Bass, happy Election Day.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Oh, okay, good.
Hope your day's off to a good start. Did you vote today or do early voting?
No, I did early voting. But you know what? I don't mail in my ballot. I go in to vote, you know?
Yeah,
I see neighbors, you get to talk to constituents. I enjoy doing that.
I'm with you on that. So let's talk about the hiring of the new police chief. And sure. The interim, of course, is in place. Where is that process out in choosing the successor to Michael Moore?
Just beginning. So, for example, we are finishing up a contract and negotiations with a national search firm. And that national search firm will begin, I would say, in the next couple of weeks. One thing that I have been doing, though, is going around town. I've been meeting with business organizations, community groups, and, of course, first and foremost, the officers. I've been to several stations. I plan to go to many, many more. And I'm asking everybody, what do they want to see in the next leader of the LAPD? And I plan to give all of those notes to the search firm so they have input from Los Angeles before they even begin the process.
All right. Let's talk about what's going on with the LA Homeless Services Authority, because as you might know, LAist broke a story last Friday that's reverberated around City Hall. We reported officials have for months kept from the public, a report ordered by the city council that found a major in homelessness enforcement policy has failed in key goals. The report from LASA said about the 41.18 policy, which clears homeless encampments, that it has been ineffective, that people have generally returned to areas that have been cleared of encampments. Your response to this?
Well, first of all, I don't know whether the report was really withheld and all of that. I can tell you that in the work that we've been doing in the mayor's office, we've never used 4118. I know that some council offices do, so it's difficult for me to comment on that. I can tell you that we have cleared encampments and some of them have repopulated, not with the same individuals, new individuals come. And we're in the process of making sure that there is no repopulation. One of the things that we plan to do, and hopefully this will help, the minute one tent shows up, we want our office called, one tent. Because what happens is you have one tent, people see that that's a place where tents can go, and within a couple of weeks, you have a whole new encampment. So we're trying to be aggressive and prevent it in the first place. And so that's the strategy that we use. Now, we have had to involve LAPD in a couple of instances because in some encampments, you do have a criminal element. And so we have needed the help, but we've never used 4118.
Well, and
whether it works well or not, I don't have an opinion.
Where should people make that contact, though? Because so often we hear from listeners, I had someone who set up a tent at a given location. I called LAPD. They said they couldn't do anything about it. So,
right.
You know, where should people call if they want to report it?
It's 311, but I do want to make a distinction because you can imagine with as many tents as they are around the city, a lot of people do call and we can't get to every single caller. But specifically, that's why we're starting to do Zoom calls with the neighborhoods. We text the neighborhoods to let them know that we're getting ready to resolve an encampment. We text them before. We text them after. We do a Zoom call with them to help them understand how to prevent the encampment, another encampment from emerging. And we give them, you know, the direct line to our staff. In general, I would tell you that people can report it to 311, but this is a citywide effort. I mean, it's impossible for a council office or the mayor's office to track everything, but if you get the community involved, we'll have a much better shot at reducing street homelessness.
And with the 4118 policy that some of the council members are using in their districts, do you know if shelter beds are being offered for all the people that are removed from a given location?
I believe so, but I honestly don't know. Again, I know of a couple of council offices that use it, but it's not been a tool in our toolbox that we have used.
All right. Another issue that's come up is whether LASA, the LA Homeless Services Agency, is only a county agency or a joint agency. Paul Krikorian, council member, wrote over the weekend that LASA, quote, is not a city agency and is not under the city's control. County Supervisor Horvath said, you know, LASA is not somebody else. It's us, City and County of Los Angeles. So who ultimately oversees LASA?
Actually, there is a commission that oversees LASA, which I've appointed myself. Lindsay Horvath appointed herself. And Catherine Barger. So you have two supervisors, myself. I do have three other appointments, so I have appointed individuals on the board. But it is, by law, a joint powers authority, which means it is the city and the county together.
All right.
And, you know, there's new leadership at LASA, and I know there have been some staff changes. I don't know the individual staff, but I don't think anybody believes that everything is going smooth at LASA. So the new leader is making some changes, and I would think that that's what you need a new leader to do.
Well, are you concerned about the number of people that have left in close succession from LASA executive positions?
I'm not. I don't have any particular reason to be concerned now. I don't think it has inhibited the functioning of the organization.
In a very general...
I respect a leader coming in and changing. I mean, I've certainly done the same thing when I took over at City Hall. It took me a while, but, you know, I certainly have made changes and will continue to make additional changes.
We're talking with LA Mayor Karen Bass. You know, in a very general sense, you know, one of the criticisms that we frequently hear of state and local governments regarding homelessness is that an incredible amount of money has been spent, including at the yes. state level in the past few years, and yet visible yes. homelessness doesn't appear to be getting better. What do you say to people who are getting discouraged that there's an answer?
Well, I do think that that is a correct criticism. A lot of money has been spent in the last year. We spend an awful lot of money getting people off the street and putting them in motel rooms. And what I'm hoping that we can do this year is come up with a better, more cost-effective way. And, you know, now there's a lot of the market has stepped in, which means companies are coming up with different innovative ways for housing to be built, and I mean manufactured short-term housing. For example, Councilwoman Hernandez opened up a new and improved tiny home village where each individual unit has a bathroom and a kitchenette, which is an improvement upon the tiny homes that have existed so far that are really extremely small, and a lot of people don't want to stay in them. The bottom line, Larry, is that to really end street homelessness, we are going to need a much more robust system of interim housing where people can stay for up to 2 years, because you know that I fast-tracked building. You know that we have thousands of units going through the process much quicker, but it still takes time. But I don't think that it is acceptable to say that while we're building something for you, you stay in a tent. We have to end street homelessness, and the only way we're going to do that is come up with interim housing. And then our biggest challenge is that the volume is so high, 46,000 people. Now, in addition, Larry, we have to develop a way of preventing homelessness. And so I believe I have said on one of your previous shows that I'm working with the Mayor's Fund, and I would encourage you to have the CEO of the Mayor's Fund, Conway Collis, on your program so he can tell you how we're trying to prevent homelessness. The bottom line was this: we have no models to work from. We are developing a way, and it's an experiment. But if we don't figure out how to stop the inflow, we're going to be in this perpetual cycle.
We're talking with LA Mayor Karen Bass. I do want to talk about your program to speed up new affordable housing, ED1,
yes.
which designed to let developers build low, moderate income apartments as well, without going through a lot of the review process that bogs those developments down. But I understand the city has started accepting environmental challenges to these ED1 projects from people opposed to new housings. Why is that?
I'm not sure that is the case. I think I know of the situation you're talking about, and I don't think it was accepted. I think it was just part of the process where it might have been scheduled, but it did not equate to an exception. But I will tell you, when you do a policy, you do have to make sure that it's working the way you originally intended. And unfortunately, there are always people that will take advantage. They will look for a loophole, and they will go through that loophole. So we have to make sure that ED1 does what it is intended to do, and there are no unintended consequences that hurt either individuals or neighborhoods.
We have some good listener questions coming in for LA Mayor Karen Bass, joining us on this election day here in Southern California. We're at 866-893-5722. If you have questions for Mayor Bass, we're going to take a brief break, and we'll continue our conversation with her in just 1 minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So glad to have you with us. With LA Mayor Karen Bass, Lisa in Echo Park emailed, are the not-for-profits paid based on per diem building or via contract? per diem billing for housed individuals, along with careful monitoring of the billing by government, is absolutely necessary. Paying by contract rather than per diem with constant monitoring by government leads to no data and poor performance. Government also needs to do on-site visits to ensure quality. That's Lisa in Echo Park. Mayor Bass, your response to that.
Well, if she is referring to the nonprofits that we contract with, so for example, when we go out to the tents and when we get people housed, we put them in a motel, and then the nonprofit actually manages the situation, the housing, the services, the food, they manage that. So if that's what they're talking about, I'm not familiar with the per diem contract. I couldn't agree more in terms of the accountability and the transparency. And one thing, and I know I've said this to you on previous shows, we have stretched the nonprofit housing community way past their capacity because we're trying to increase getting people off the street. And so I'm concerned that we need to have a higher quality of services, better consistency, transparency, and outcome measures. And so to address that, I've hired a medical doctor, actually, who's on board now as the deputy mayor for homelessness, so she can pay attention to improving the model of service delivery to the people in the motels. For example, one thing that worries me is we have people in motels. What are they doing all day? I mean, there needs to be programming. People need to have direct, immediate access to health care. I don't think a lot of people think about it. When they think of people who are unhoused, they think of substance abuse and mental health. But a lot of people who've been on the street for a long time are suffering from traditional chronic diseases, high blood pressure, diabetes, you know, et cetera. And then we need to work with the individuals because whatever led to their lives collapsing in housing, we know affordability is a key issue, but it's not the only issue. So we need to have, we need to work with them to help them get their lives back on track. So when we move them to permanent housing, it'll be successful.
Well, Mayor Bass, you know, something we don't often think about, too, for people who have been, you know, living on the streets for a prolonged period of time and then moving into interim or permanent housing, there's whole skills about living in a place and maintaining it and keeping one's things that can be very difficult for people. And I don't mean this in a critical way. I just mean when you're living in survival mode on the street and you're moved into a structure, it's not like that fixes all of the life management things that have gone on. And do people get help sort of just managing living indoors again?
Not to what I believe should be the standard, no. Yes, there is some help that's there, but I think there needs to be much more intensive help. I mean, if you think about it, you've been living in a tent for a number of years, like you said, in survival mode. Just putting somebody in a building does not solve everything. I believe in housing first. I do. But I would say housing and services first. We need to look at what happened in that individual's life that it broke down. You know, I don't come from the housing world. You know, I come from healthcare. I come from healthcare and social services. And so I think there's a lot of people who are experts in housing, but not necessarily experts in the population that needs to be housed. That's why bringing on a physician, we're going to bring on social workers so that we can help bolster the services that the community-based organizations are providing. And again, I want to emphasize, because I'm not critical of them, I think they're doing the best they can, but we've stretched them way beyond what they're used to because that's the need in our city.
We're talking with L.A. Mayor Karen Bass. I have a couple of questions about animal services. Joey emailed, I've been doing animal rescue for over 10 years. The crisis has never been to this extent. My rescue has saved at least 80 dogs in just the past few months on Skid Row, where dogs are continuously being bred. I had a meeting with Stacey Danes, and she said her animal control officers won't go to Skid Row because it's too dangerous. Admitting Skid Row is lawless and they continue to breed with no consequences. It's a major issue. I'm just limiting what Joey says because it's a very long email. But and then Sasha in West LA says, what does the mayor plan to do about the crisis at LA's animal shelters? Mayor Bass.
So we do have a new general manager and we do have a lot that we need to do. We have increased funding to the shelters so that they could bring on more staff. We need more veterinarians, and we also need more assistance for our volunteers. So we are addressing the situation, but the individual and what the person is saying is correct. I will tell you, though, it's the first time I've heard about animal services staff not going to Skid Row, so I will follow up with that. I've never heard that before. If that is the case, we can make sure that they go with support so that they're not, you know, they don't have to deal with fear. But it is a problem, and it's definitely something we need to continue to work on. I will be releasing some policy initiatives in this area in the next, I would say, couple of weeks.
And what do you have a grasp of what the problem is? Is it a lack of money to just handle the number of pets that are showing up at animal services? Is a turnover of personnel? What's happening?
I think it's multiple things. Number one, I'm sure you're aware that during the pandemic, a lot of people adopted pets. And then after the pandemic was ending, they then turned those pets over. So you have overcrowding from that perspective. You do have a severe staff shortage. You have a severe shortage of veterinarians. You do have animals that are in the shelters who are dangerous, who have bitten staff and injured staff, some with life-altering injuries, staff and volunteers. So we need to address the dogs that truly are dangerous. So I think it's a multitude of issues. That's why we increase the funding so we could begin to address that. And then there's the issue of breeding. And, you know, a lot of that is difficult because breeding can be done and often is done underground. And so finding out, you know, who is doing breeding and where is that taking place. All of these are issues that that we need to address.
LA Mayor Karen Bass joining us on Air Talk. Of course, the LA Olympic Games are coming up in 2028. Paris has its Olympics this year. Mayor Bass, how are preparations going?
Well, I think preparations are going very well in our city. And let me just say on your show that tomorrow I will be leading a delegation to Paris. I'll be going with Council President Paul Krikorian, Council Members Tracy Park and Yaroslavsky. The three of them are on our ad hoc Olympics committee. LA Metro CEO Stephanie Wiggins will be going. LA 84 Foundation President and CEO Renata Semera will be going. So we want to go because this is our only opportunity to learn about preparations for the Olympics. Of course, I'll be back for the opening and closing games. But before the games happen, what is Paris doing? How is the business community involved? How are the small businesses involved? How are they dealing with their unhoused population? All of the things that go into preparing for the Olympics. It'll be a very short trip. I leave tomorrow. I arrive in Paris Thursday. I'll be back on Sunday. It was unfortunate that Nick Gerda is not able to go with us, but we did invite him. We will be bringing several media representatives because I want the city to always see what I'm doing. But I definitely am hoping that this trip can help excite LA about all that we need to do. Maybe it'll be a further inspiration for people to say, we all need to have skin in our game around the unhoused population. We don't want Olympics coverage in 2028 to show wonderful venues, wonderful games, and then cut away to tents. We really want to have this situation resolved before 28. So I'm excited, and we will keep you posted.
That's great. Looking forward to what you learn. And, of course, transportation is key with all the spread-out facilities here in Southern California. And are you going to be looking in detail at what the transit plans are there in Paris to move people from venue to venue?
Absolutely. That's why the CEO of Metro, and you know I chair Metro, that the both of us will be there with that specific issue in mind.
All right. And of course, Paris has the Metro, which is a very successful way of getting people around. What can we anticipate when it comes to the build out of our transit projects by 2028? Are all the projects that have been designated for funding, are they all going to be done in time for the games?
Yes, they should be. You know, anything can happen. Fingers crossed. Yes, everything will stay on track, including the People Mover, which is really going to be phenomenal at LAX, you know, with the centralized parking structure that will include parking for rental cars, and you'll be able to take the train. If you have been to the airport in San Francisco, to me, our people mover is similar to that, although ours, of course, will be much larger.
All right. LA Mayor Karen Bass joining us on Air Talk and announcing this trip in which a delegation led by the mayor with multiple civic agency heads and elected officials going to Paris for the next few days in preparation for the 2028 Los Angeles Olympiad. Let's talk a bit about the graffiti building in downtown Los Angeles. This has gotten global attention. Some love it because they see it as an artistic representation of a debacle, an unfinished project that was designed under a cloud. Others see it as an eyesore. So how do you view the graffiti buildings?
Well, I will tell you that I've been preoccupied with that building since I took over last December, because when I look at it, I look at the potential for housing. Incredible building that was set up for 700 units of luxury housing. I'm not sure we need more luxury housing, but if you could imagine how many units we could get for workforce housing or housing for seniors, any number of things that we need in our city. I'm very concerned about it. I think it is dangerous. The fence will be finished soon, so I think that will prohibit people from going in. And you know, the most frightening thing was people literally parachuting off of the building. But even the graffiti, aside from, in my opinion, it being an eyesore, it is extremely dangerous for people to be up there, you know, doing graffiti. So I am hopeful that we will be able to bring this situation to a close. And then, you know, to think about it, the individual who owns that building is a fugitive in China. He was the individual that was involved in the bribery case with Jose Huizar. So I think it's just terrible, and it needs to be addressed soon.
It's hair-raising to see the video of those guys hanging off the building like that. I couldn't watch it. It was too terrifying to see them.
And so when I say, you know, I've been preoccupied with it since December of 2022, I, you know, have moved to see if there was any way possible we could take that building. We could have that building. We could bring someone in who could do some development that would really be helpful to our city.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you before we conclude, Mayor Bass, that the city's anticipating a $400 million budget gap next year. There's been criticism of raises approved, significant raises for the LAPD and for other city employees expected to follow because of the raises that public safety employees are getting. And the concern is this is blowing a hole in the budget. Are you concerned about the fiscal future of the city with these raises?
No, I'm not. I mean, of course, we have a fiscal situation that we have to be concerned about. My bigger concern, of course, is the state and the nation in terms of, you know, we can do whatever we want in the city, but we're also impacted by the broader economy. But it was critical to give law enforcement those raises. We complain about safety. We complain that we don't have enough officers. Well, we were losing officers to other cities, to other jurisdictions. And so we were losing officers mid-career. They would leave and go someplace else. People are concerned about the lack of city services. Well, we have major shortages in our workforce. So we're going to manage the hiring. You know, we have thousands of vacancies. We're going to continue to hire in critical areas that the community needs. For example, we had 900 vacancies in sanitation. You want to know why the streets are dirty? Why your streets are not repaired? We had several hundred vacancies in street services. So we are definitely going to slow down hiring, but we will not slow down hiring in critical areas that impact basic quality of life and city services. And the economy are local in terms of our budget. We are in a healthy situation in terms of our reserves and all of that. People draw comparisons to what happened several years ago when we hit the Great Recession and raises that were given. It was an entirely different economic picture then than it is now. So we're going to have to tighten our belts. but I do not think that the raises were inappropriate. A few minutes ago, we were just talking about how expensive it is to live in terms of our housing problem. You know, the reports are showing that more than 60% of city workers can't even afford to live in L.A. So we have to figure out, in terms of our priorities, we say we want certain things. Well, the things that we want cost money, and we have to figure out how to manage and improve the quality of life in Los Angeles at the same time.
Mayor Bass, safe travels to Paris, and we look forward to talking with you soon about what you've learned from the trip in preparation for the 2028 Los Angeles Games.
I'll be happy to give you a report when I return.
Sounds great. Thank you so much, Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass, joining us on Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I do want to remind you that we have extensive election coverage on this California primary and Super Tuesday, and that coverage is throughout the day from NPR as well as here on LAist 89.3 with our local reporters and our hourly newscasts. Then at 5 o'clock, we begin with continuous election coverage through the evening and into the late night. It begins at 5 with Nick Roman, joined by NPR's national coverage of Super Tuesday. As the polls start closing across the country, you'll get those election returns, and not just on the presidential primaries, but some of the important state-by-state issues that are being voted on there, and congressional races that are critically important to the composition of both the House and the Senate. And then at 7 o'clock, it's a statewide broadcast, including KQED, our fellow NPR member station in San Francisco, and our Austin Cross, who'll be anchoring that statewide coverage from 7 until 8 o'clock right here on LAist 89.3. And then I'll be back with you at 8 o'clock with our civics and democracy correspondent, Frank Stoltz, and with Jill Replogle, who not only covers Orange County, but put together the voter game plan Orange County section to give you all that information you need to be a prepared Orange County voter. The three of us will bring you the returns as the polls close from 8 o'clock on. We'll have analysts who'll be joining us talking about the major races and issues and some of the early trends that we see in those early returns. All the coverage starting at 5 o'clock today with Nick Roman and NPR. 7 o'clock with Austin Cross and our statewide broadcast with KQED. And from 8 o'clock on, I'll be with you with the trio here hosting our LAist specific coverage. Have a terrific rest of the election day. Remember, the polls are open until 8 o'clock throughout Southern California. Have a terrific day. I'll talk with you later this evening.